right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm very excited to be reporting to you from New York City today, bringing you all the news and voices from Rise Up October. The whole show today is going to focus on Rise Up October, what happened during 3 days of fighting against police terror, murder, and brutality. On Thursday, October 22nd, it was the National Day of Protest to stop police brutality, murder, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. And this was marked by the event, No More Stolen Lives, Say Their Names in Times Square, New York City, a public reading, remembrance, and demand for justice, a gathering with families whose loved ones have been murdered by the police, along with prominent voices of conscience from the arts, literature, clergy, and more, to say their names and demand that murder by police must stop now. And we'll hear voices from this event, including family members, playwright Eve Ensler, Quentin Tarantino, Gina Belafonte, and more. And on the next day, Friday, October 23rd, it was Shut Down Rikers Day, a day calling for nonviolent direct action to close down the Guantanamo on the Hudson. And people of conscience came out to put their bodies on the line to call for this torture chamber to be shut down. And as part of the reporting on this event, we'll hear an interview I did with Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution newspaper, RevCom.us, and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And I talked with Sansara about what Rikers is and why it's so important to shut it down. We're also going to hear a report from Lee Ernesto, a writer for Revolution newspaper, right after the action on Friday the 23rd. Then I'll fill you in on what happened on Saturday, October 24th, the National March to Stop Police Terror. Which side are you on? Thousands marched through the streets of Manhattan. We'll be hearing from and about that event in coming weeks as well. Today, we're going to hear an interview I did with director, actor, and writer Quentin Tarantino about why he spoke and marched during Rise Up October and why people have to take a side. And we'll hear some of the voices of family members who played such a powerful role in all 3 days. So opening the show up, and I'm very pleased to be bringing this to you, Thursday, October 22nd was the kickoff event for Rise Up October. It was an event that was called Stolen Lives, Say Their Names. It happened in Times Square and it featured a lot of people, victims, family members of people who've been murdered by the police, telling their stories, telling the stories of their loved ones, and prominent people reading the names of the people who have been killed. It was a very, very moving time. It was a very moving thing and really important in terms of basically people recognizing this terrible crime against humanity and starting to draw a line and make a decision. People being confronted with that decision of what side are you on? So let's, without any further ado, we're going to check out just some sound from that for a little while, and then we'll be back. So check this out.
Morning, everyone. Rise up! Rise up! Stop police brutality and murder. I'm here this morning with Tony to sadly read the names and the stories of people whose lives have been stolen. So we'll begin. And before I begin, I just want to say that we honor all the people's lives that we read. We hold them in our hearts. We remember them. And we read their names in the hope and the resistance that these murders no longer continue. Calvin Moore, 18-year-old black teenager, Kilby Correctional Facility, Alabama. On February 21st, 1996, Calvin was allowed to die after losing 56 pounds in 1 month and being left without medical care while in custody.
Edwin Wingo, 39 years old, Atlanta. On September 4th, 1997, Edwin died in the back seat of a police car from a gunshot to the head. Though he had been searched twice before being put in the car, police claim he killed himself.
Robert Whitlow, 45, Louisville, Kentucky. On March 13, 1997, Robert was shot in the back and side after a SWAT team exploded 2 flash bang grenades and entered his home. He was a former Block Watch captain.
Maya Hall, a 27-year-old black transgender woman, Baltimore. On March 30th, 2015, Maya was killed by the police 28 miles from an NSA guard post that she and her friend allegedly crashed into.
That was playwright and activist Eve Ensler and her friend Tony Montaneri reading the names and telling the stories of some of the people who have been killed by the police over the last few decades. When they were finished reading, I had a chance to talk to Eve about why she felt compelled to be part of this movement.
What compels me to do this is that we are living in a country where state violence is essentially licensed, where we have no checks and balances, where people are not being held accountable. I mean, listen to all the stories I read today. How many cops were indicted? How many cops were held responsible? How many people were armed that were shot down? How many people were mentally ill that weren't treated as mentally ill people? So we're living in a country now where hundreds of black and brown women and men are being murdered, are being killed without any justice. And for me, this is my country. I live here. And I am responsible for that. And all of us are responsible for that. We are talking about a war right now that's going on the lives of black and brown bodies on the streets. And I feel this is my struggle. Those are my brothers and sisters.
Now, one thing that happened, too, is that as you're talking about this war that's going on, I agree with you 100%. And it's a war now that in certain senses, well, I was thinking about it. I've been fighting around this for like 20 years.
Yeah.
And you think about this, and you're talking tens of thousands of people that we know about. But then you think about it now in terms of what does that add up to? And there's been some people, and I know we've looked at it in a certain sense of saying that there's a genocidal aspect to this. It's slow now, but it's also very dangerous.
Oh, I absolutely think this is a continuation of the same slave mentality, the same destruction towards black bodies that's been going on in this country forever. And I think it all just happens in more insidious or more sophisticated or more, you know, it just gets moved into another direction. But I also think we need to be looking at why aren't we as a country standing up to say to the state, to the police forces, you cannot do this. You cannot go after. Look at people like Tanisha Anderson. Look at people who were mentally ill, who called to reach out for help. In the course of reaching out, they got murdered, right? Look at people who are in prisons, who are having toilet paper stuffed down their throats and killed. I mean, reading those stories this morning, I just sit here and go, where are we living? What kind of country is this that supports this kind of violence and supports this kind of brutality? And people need to wake up, because this kind of state violence is being employed on a lot of people, and it's creating a state of violence. It's a state of terror. Black people in this country and brown people in this country live in terror of driving in their cars, of walking down their streets. They don't know what's going to happen to them any moment. They live a terror state. So we are all responsible for changing that.
And one of the things that this action is meant to do is to draw a line very clearly and challenge people around which side are you on. How do you view that?
Well, I think one of the things we do is tell the stories, like we did this morning. I think when you hear the stories and you hear what's happened to people and you hear the lack of justice, right? It's very hard not to say you have to get up and do something, you know? So I believe in telling stories. And I was very happy this morning, although I was incredibly sad and heartbroken to read the stories. I think it's really important we say what has happened so people hear the details, because details for me is what makes me respond to things.
One last question. How do you see stopping this?
By what we're doing. I mean, I've been a grassroots activist my whole life. I've been in the streets my whole life. I think the way we change everything is when grassroots numbers swell, when we build unified movements that stand in solidarity, when white people understand that this is our struggle, that we have to get deeply involved in allyship and in solidarity with anybody who is being threatened or murdered by the police, and by marching, by doing civil disobedience, by speaking out, by telling the stories, by educating yourself, by learning about what's happening and not being uninformed and pretending it's not happening all around you. And also by feeling what it feels like. I mean, how many friends of mine, friends of color, talk to me about what it's like to live in this country and how their sons, when they go out, how they worry if they'll ever come back, and they've done nothing. How they could be in some car, could be at some moment at the wrong time, and before they know it, they're shot dead. That is real, and that is all of our struggle.
All right, Eve Ensler, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and these are some of the voices from the event Stolen Lives, hashtag Say Their Names, that took place in Times Square on October 22nd. This event was the opening day of 3 days of action against police murder and brutality, all culminating in an important march on Saturday, October 24th, when the streets of New York City should be flooded with all of those who refuse to tolerate such terrible crimes against humanity.
Say their names. Clifford T. Manuel. A 39-year-old black man, Seaford, Delaware, on August 2nd, 1999. Clifford was shot and killed after being stopped for riding his bike after dark. He loved his wife and stepchildren and playing basketball.
Say their names. Ronnie Banks LaLusa, 30-year-old Samoan man, Honolulu. In January 22nd, 1998, Ronnie was struck by 14 bullets from police officers for holding two knives. A former cellmate of Rodney said he was depressed and trying to commit suicide by having the cops kill him. Witnesses said the cops shot him twice. Rodney fell to his knees, dropped the knives, and he was shot several times after.
Say their names. Cedric Harris, a 27-year-old black man, Shreveport, Louisiana. On July 24th, 1998, Cedric, a wheelchair-bound paraplegic, was shot in the back and killed.
Say their names. Shanika Park Proctor, an 18-year-old black woman, Bessemer, Alabama. On November 1st, 2014, Shanika was arrested for disorderly conduct. Shanika suffered from asthma, but guards ignored her request for treatment. She was found in her cell dead the next morning. The police department refused to release the video footage of her in her cell to her family.
Lois Boyd once said, "The dead cannot bury the dead. The dead cannot speak out. It is up to the living to be their voice." My name is Hortensia Peterson. Akai Gurley was my nephew. I am standing here today in proxy of my sister Sylvia Palmer and Kenneth Palmer, Akai's parents. Akai was a father of a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old. Akai was a loving dad. He was very passionate in working on exotic cars. He was a mama's boy. He loved his mother. Akai did nothing wrong, but decided to take the flight of stairs. 11 months ago, on November 12th, my nephew Akai celebrated his 28th birthday. 8 days later, he was murdered by a rookie police officer named Peter Liang, and his partner, Sean Lando, who was doing vertical patrol in the Pink Houses projects in Brooklyn, New York. Akai and a friend was waiting for the elevator. When it didn't come, they decided to take the stairs. It is a problem for anyone to walk in the stairs. What crime are you committing? You're not committing any crime. But because of Peter Liang and Sean Lando, my nephew is dead. My sister has a deep hole in her heart that cannot be replaced, cannot be healed. She is broken until she leaves this earth. My nephew Akai loved life. He was in the process of leaving New York City. He was in the process of moving out of this corrupted city where all these cops are murderers. The whole funny thing about it, they're protected by the law. They have to be held accountable for taking a life. If it was an accident, man up. The governor, the president, the Department of Justice, the whole entire justice system needs to be dismantled. We are losing our sons, our husbands, our mothers, our daughters. We are losing our family members because of police brutality. This must stop. Rise up, stand with the families of police brutality, because we are here to be the voice for the dead. We are here. I thank you and God bless.
Could everybody say my son's name, Angelo Miller? Okay, I am Alicia Kirkman from Cleveland, Ohio. I am so sick and tired of the police killing our kids, because when they kill our kids, they kill a part of us. We would never, ever in our life be the same. My son was 17 years old. Him and his friends did something that they were not supposed to do. But how many of us never did anything being a teenager that we were not supposed to do? So the police officer shot my son's car up 8 times. You heard my son on the 911 tape saying, "My hands are up, sir. I swear to God, I don't have nothing. I'm not doing nothing." How can they continue to kill our kids and try to pay us off? Why can't the police be put in jail for killing our kids? I am sick and tired. I am so happy that all of the mothers that we are getting together, this is the beginning of this, because they need to stop it. And I am so sick and tired every time I see a young person, I don't care the age of the person. Every time I see that someone have got killed by the police, I would never, ever in my life heal. It brings back nightmares. So we're going to continue to fight this battle. And today is not the end. This is just the beginning. This is the beginning of it.
My name is Kadeen Williams. This is my youngest brother, O'Shane Evans. I am my brother's keeper. I said I am my brother's keeper. I'm gonna continue to fight for O'Shane. A part of me is gone. I will never get that part back. To see my mother go through what she goes through every day, it's not a good feeling. I tell them in San Francisco every day when it rains, my blood is running in the streets. You're taking a part of me. America! America! I'm tired! I'm tired! How many more? How many more lives are you gonna take? From America to the Middle East, to Mexico, to Vietnam! How many more are we gonna let them take? It's time to stand up and fight back, people! Quit asking your oppressor for something that you're not gonna get! How dare you keep on asking these same people that's been oppressing us for years for something! You have to take it! Quit putting your hands up and saying don't shoot! Put that fist up and fight back! Fight back, people! Fight back! This is my beloved brother, O'Shane Evans. Shane would have gave you the shirt off of his back. On October 7, 2014, he was sitting in his mother's car. San Francisco police said that his friends broke into someone's car and ran back to his car. And when they got back to the car, they claimed that O'Shane pulled an unloaded gun on them. Bullshit! And I don't want that investigation that you're doing. How the hell does the police investigate the police so you can keep that? Because I don't want it! First you said that O'Shane had a shootout. But how can a man have a shootout with an unloaded gun? Another bullshit that I'm not trying to hear. My brother did not pull a gun on an officer. My brother did not have a gun, period. You killed him. You shot him in his head, shot him in his heart. You took his life. Senseless. And you continue to do it. Why? Because the system continues to back you. The system continues to back these gangbangers. These boys in blues, you look at them. When they talk about thugs, if Obama want to talk about thugs, look at the real thugs. Who are the thugs? Those are thugs. That's the thugs over there. Okay? Not going to say no more about my brother, but long live O'Shane Evans. And as long as I have breath in my body, I will continue to fight for him. I'm going to fight till the day I die for my brother. And if we don't get no justice, they won't get no peace. If we don't get no justice, they won't get no peace. Thank you.
Please welcome Gina Belafonte and Quentin Tarantino.
Antonio Renteria. Say his name.
Antonio Renteria.
A 23-year-old Mexican immigrant, U.S.-Mexico border, Arizona, on September 9. 1998, Antonio was struck 3 times by semi-automatic fire from a Border Patrol agent.
John Spiganisi, Say his name.
John Spaganisi.
45 years old, Danielson, Connecticut. On November 22nd, 1998, John, a nature conservationist, was killed by an off-duty cop who was hunting illegally. John was a recipient of the Medal for Meritorious Services by the Department of Environmental Protection 4 months earlier.
Brenna Shane Noe, say her name.
Brenna Shane Noe.
17 months. Louisville, Kentucky, on November 26, 1997. 7-month-old Brenna was beaten to death by an off-duty cop who was her mother's fiancé. The cop had been named Officer of the Year 1 week before he killed Brenna.
Freddie Gray Jr.
Freddie Gray Jr.
Say his name, Freddie Gray Jr.
Freddie Gray Jr.
A 25-year-old black man, Baltimore. On April 19, 2014, Freddie was walking down the street in his own neighborhood when cops stopped him. He was kicked, beaten, tased, and then thrown in the back of a police van while handcuffed. When the police pulled him out, his spinal cord was 80% severed. A medical examiner ruled his death as homicide, and the 6 cops involved were indicted and are awaiting trial.
All right, welcome back. That was the voice of Quentin Tarantino and Gina Belafonte in the end. And the two people who were introducing, who were reading names earlier that didn't get identified, was the Grammy Award-winning musician Arturo O'Farrell and Benga, and the actor Benga Akinagbe. All right, so check this out, sisters and brothers. This was just a handful of people out of the many people who showed up yesterday to be there and the many, many more families that are going to be there testifying about the horror that happened to them. Think about what it means. You've heard these names listed. You've heard people talk. We're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of people, of families who've lived through this, thousands that we just know about. It's time to rise up and say we will not tolerate that anymore. This cannot be allowed. It's a crime against humanity, and we should never forget that. Right now, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk about shutting down Rikers Island, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. And that was Jasiri X with Don't Let Them Get Away With Murder. And that's something to keep in your mind this weekend and all the time. Do not let them get away with murder. All right, right now, we're just going to rush through this thing because we got so much to say today. We're going to have Sansara Taylor, a conversation I had with her a couple days ago about why this was happening and what was going on with Rikers Island. And then after that, we'll be talking with Leonesta, who was out there with the event. So here's Sansara Taylor right now. Just 300 yards from the runways at LaGuardia Airport, just a few miles from a glistening city, an island sits dedicated to confinement, brutality, and torture of our youth and others. And this island is Rikers Island. It's the big New York City prison, and there is an action called at Rikers Island on October 23rd, Friday, October 23rd. It's a nonviolent direct action as part of Rise Up October. And joining me to talk about this now is Sansara Taylor, who has been very active in this whole effort. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be with you.
So why Rikers? What's going on?
Well, Rikers Island it's been called the Abu Ghraib of New York City. It's Guantanamo on the Hudson. Rikers Island, people should know, it's one of the largest jail complexes, prison complexes in the world. On an average night, 14,000 prisoners are housed there, confined, caged, locked up. 85% of the people at Rikers Island have never even been convicted of a crime. They've never been given a trial. They're there as it's a debtor's prison. They're there because they couldn't make bail. They're there because they're black and Latino. 95% of the people in Rikers Island are black or Latino. It is really, it's a place where the whole demonization, criminalization, and mass incarceration of black and brown people is concentrated. There's 14,000 human beings warehoused, and the conditions are barbaric. There's rampant brutality by guards. There's widespread torture. There's widespread sexual assault. 40% of the people on Rikers Island have diagnosed mental illnesses, and they're the people who are the most often beaten by guards, the most often hospitalized by guards. In one 11-month period, there were 5 prisoners who were driven to such despair that they attempted suicide in Rikers Island, and they were responded to by the guards by being beaten so viciously they were then put in the hospital again. This is a place that is a crime against humanity, and it needs to be shut down.
Now, one of the things that you've talked about before, when I heard you speak before on this, you also talked about, you gave some very specific examples of, like, what actually are the conditions that, you know, some of the more just gut-wrenching conditions that when you hear about them, it sort of knocks you back in your seat. Give people a sense of that, because you've actually referred to this as sort of, you've referred to it as a concentration camp, you've referred to it as an Abu Ghraib in New York City in the U.S. Let's talk about why you're saying that.
Well, I think one case that typifies and concentrates everything that's wrong with Rikers, everything that's wrong with mass incarceration in this country, is the story of Kalief Browder. He was a 16-year-old young man hanging out with his friends on Arthur Avenue one night up in the Bronx. He was walking, minding his own business, and the police rolled up on him. They grabbed him and his friend. They accused him of stealing a backpack. They never produced any evidence that he stole a backpack. They didn't produce any evidence that night. They didn't produce it that week. They didn't produce it that year. They didn't produce evidence against him for 3 years. And yet Kalief Browder was sent to Rikers Island because his family couldn't make a few $1,000 bail. He's 16 years old. He missed his summer vacation. He missed his last 2 years of high school. He missed his prom. He missed all the things that young people his age were out doing. He was locked up in 2 of those years of the 3. He was in solitary confinement. This is torture by international standards. He's, again, never even given a trial. And he was there. I mean, it's typical. So 14% of the minors who've been held at Rikers Island have been through solitary. It's inhumane. And then the adults as well. So after years of refusing to plea to any charges because he was maintaining his innocence and there was never any evidence put against him, Kalief Browder was finally released after 3 years. He had been so traumatized, so damaged by the torture, by the barbarity and the brutality of guards. There's video that came out of the guards beating him. There's video of other inmates being set upon him as the guards watched. There's, you know, he lost weight. He was hungry. A lot of people, they go hungry in Rikers Island. After this, he got out. He had a few months that he was out. And he couldn't get beyond it. He couldn't get a job. He'd spent this time in jail. Girls that he'd meet, that he'd want to go on a date with, they'd say, well, what have you been up to? Why don't you have your high school degree? And he'd freeze up. He couldn't talk about what he had been through. He was so isolated and so alienated. June 6th this year, he took his life. And now we put that on Rikers Island. We put that on the whole Jim Crow of mass incarceration. We put that on this system that has demonized, criminalized, and branded Black and Latino youth as not deserving the rights, you know, any rights, as long as they're called a criminal. And, you know, Kalief Browder, this typifies, this concentrates Rikers Island. I mean, if we had all week, we could tell the stories for weeks. When we go out in any oppressed neighborhood throughout this city, up in Harlem is one example in the projects, everybody has an intimate experience with Rikers. People have children locked up there. People have children suffering physical ailments and diseases that they can't get treatment for. They have loved ones there. They've been through there. They describe it as a slave plantation. To go and visit, you have to go through cavity searches. You have to open your mouth. They say it's just like slavery days, like being inspected on the way into, you know, on the auction block. And so this, it is the kind of thing, and it's right next to New York City. And it's an open secret. And what we're saying with this nonviolent direct action, what we're saying with this demand, shut down Rikers Island, what we're saying when we are going to put our bodies on the line is that the exposure has been done. Lawsuit after lawsuit has been filed. Settlements of guard brutality and wrongful death have been paid out again and again. Reforms have been demanded again and again, year after year. And nothing has changed. Actually, the brutality from the guards has escalated. And so we're saying that if we don't do more than that, if we don't put ourselves on the line to stop this, then we're complicit because we know what's going on.
Now, I want to talk about that a little bit more in a minute, but I also wanted to ask you one thing, because one of the things that has come up every time I've heard you speak about this, and I think it's something people don't really understand, is that Rikers is not sort of, it's not like, you know, a lot of people could just be bozos and say, well, you know, there's a lot of kids that are doing stuff that's wrong. There's a lot of people that are out in the streets that are doing stuff that's wrong. I don't care how old you are, what your status in society you have. If you're doing something wrong, you got to, you know, if you're going to do the crime, you got to do the time, right? That's a lot of people will say that kind of stuff, as bad as they might think it happens. But there's actually another aspect to this. And I think your exposure of what's going on in Rikers is clearly speaks to, the, you know, what's actually happening. But there's another point here that you've brought up many times, which is that many of the people that are in Rikers have never even been charged with a crime. I mean, this is, you know, you think about this. When you want to talk about concentration camp type things, mm-hmm. never charged for a crime and can spend years and years in there. Let's talk about that a minute.
Yeah, I think that's really important. It's by design. I think people have to understand this. This is not an accident. This is an open secret. It's widely known. The majority of people in Rikers Island, 85%, have not had a trial. The DA and the courts, they always say, oh, we're so backlogged. There's so many criminals. We can't keep up with this. It takes so long to get to them. That's not the truth. The truth is they don't want to give people a hearing. They put a lot of pressure on them. You sit in jail. The majority of people cop a plea because copping a plea to a charge that they're being charged with would serve less time than they serve waiting for a trial. So then you have all these people who are locked up. They've done nothing wrong. They've never had a day in court. And they cop a plea because they're being held in a debtor's prison in a concentration camp, and there's no way to get out if you don't. And then they come out, and they have a criminal record. Then it follows them everywhere. Then they get profiled again. They get stopped and frisked again. They get rounded up and wrongfully grabbed. Or they have some minor scuffle that a lot of white people have, too. They have a little drug possession. They have all kinds of whatever that happens that white people have, middle-class people have, and they go about their lives again. But with these people, they have a criminal record. Black and brown and impoverished youth, they have a record because they copped a plea, because they didn't get a day in court, because they were being tortured and caged until they did so, and then they're locked, they're sent away for a much longer time. And this goes on again and again. We had a woman who told us about her son who was rounded up based on Facebook posts up in the projects in Grant Homes and Manhattanville projects up in Harlem. And her son has sickle cell anemia. He just got sentenced to 6 years based on Facebook posts, based on youthful bravado and his associations. No crime had he committed. And the judge literally said to him, to the child and with his parents watching in court and a whole lot of witnesses, I have a cell. He said, I have a cell for you to die in. His mother pleaded that he's sick, he's not well, he won't hold up, and the judge literally said that to him. And this is the way the system despises and demonizes. And I'll say, a lot of these people have never committed any serious offense. But even if you have done something really, really horrendous, nobody deserves to be tortured. Nobody deserves to be brutalized. People are hog-tied and beaten. 80% of the people who went to a hospital off of beatings from guards said they were beaten after they were handcuffed. This is a place that is just, it's depraved, it's barbaric. Nobody deserves to be treated this way. And a society that tolerates this, a population that accepts this, that says, oh, because they're supposedly criminals, because their skin is brown, because they don't speak English, because they don't come from here, because they are of a section of people who this society says are not human, we're going to look the other way as they're tortured. This is not a society that anybody should accept. I wish I could say that Rikers was unique. Rikers typifies what goes on with mass incarceration. Rikers typifies what goes on with millions and millions of people all across this country who are caught up in the criminal injustice system. And so when we put our bodies on the line to shut down Rikers Island, when we put ourselves out there and say we are going to take this stand, we're doing it not just for the people at Rikers, not just for the families, the millions of families who've had their lives torn apart when they have a loved one being tortured inside Rikers and they're powerless to do anything about it. We're doing it because this is a key part of shining a light on and moving people in this country to say we have to stand up and put our bodies on the line nationwide across this country to stop this genocide.
We'll begin to wrap this up just by going back to sort of that, but also what you said earlier, because there is this point, and I, you know, it's stunning when I listen to what the exposure that you do around this, and I've read about it, and I know something about it, but still, I look at it, and it always hits me that this is not unknown. Mm. You know, that the federal government was the most recent thing to issue a big report on conditions at Rikers, you know, and nothing has been done at all that would alleviate or you know, sit back and say, okay, this is going on. We're going to shut this down. We're going to take care of this. Wait, stop this. Instead, it's just continued to roll along. The trains keep running to the concentration camps and the people keep dying and suffering. I wanted to talk about that, just the idea that even people here in the city, a number of people know that Rikers is a hellhole. They may not know all the various conditions, but they have some sense of it. Even and from every class, I think you were mentioning that before, from the people who actually live the experience, but also to the people who read about the reports in the New York Times or wherever. This action, how do you see that, and how do you see the impact of this action on that, what you're trying to do?
Well, I think one thing that's really critical is that when we talk about the new Jim Crow of mass incarceration, when we call it a slow genocide, these are not an attempt to rile people up and speak hyperbolically. This is because what is being done through mass incarceration, through police terror, through the brutality inside these jails and prisons, what's being done through the crushing and stealing of whole generations of young people's lives and futures is every bit as ingrained and entrenched in America as slavery was, as Jim Crow was, as lynch mob terror was. And one thing that we have learned, anybody who's honest, anybody who looks honestly at the history of this country and its present reality, nothing fundamental has changed for the oppressed for the better without people putting their bodies on the line, without people putting their reputations on the line, without people risking their own futures, their own livelihoods, their own aspirations to say that we're not going to turn our backs on what's happening and this has to stop. And what we've recognized, look, as you said, the exposure's been done. The lawsuits have been filed. Even the federal government has filed lawsuits. This has been done. This is not going to stop because we wag our fingers at the authorities. This is not going to stop because we say, oh, please be more humane. They know better than most people how brutal these places are. They know better because they've paid out settlements after settlements, wrongful death after wrongful death, brutality after brutality. What's missing is not the exposure. What's missing is not the lawsuits. Those things are essential. They're important. But what's missing is people who will say, you know what, we refuse to live in a society that does this. And with this nonviolent direct action, with this demand and protest and organized effort as part of Rise Up October to shut down Rikers Island, what we are saying is that our bodies are not more precious than the bodies of those 14,000 human beings, brothers, sisters, mothers, parents, lovers who are locked in Rikers Island. Our potential to end up with a record, which we don't want, but our potential to end up with a record or be arrested or be brutalized for doing so is not more precious than those who are locked down, who are having their lives foreclosed without any choice in the matter. You know, we have students and young people who are afraid to take this stand but are deciding to take it. One of them who is, a number of them who are saying, man, my parents, they have such hopes for me. They're going to be really upset. And we talked about it. We said, look, your parents' aspirations for you are no more precious than the aspirations and the hopes that the parents of these young people in Rikers Island are. And so we're going to have people there who are bearing witness, who are standing with us, who are protesting, who are not doing the nonviolent direct action, and their voices are important. And everybody who stands up in any capacity is an essential part of this. But the truth is that some people do have to put ourselves on the line, and some of us have chosen to do that. I am doing that. Reverend Willie Francois is doing that. Reverend Phelps is doing that. Carl Dix is doing that. There's a number of students and others who are joining together to do that, because if we don't do it, who's going to do it? And if we do it, it's part of how we fight to change. We want the people in Rikers to know that they matter that much, that we see them as human. We want the people throughout this city and throughout this country to see that too. And we want the people who've been sitting at home saying, oh, it's such a shame. It's really wrong. I feel bad about Rikers. We want them to see, no, you have to actually act. And there are people acting. And there's no excuse to sit on the sidelines. You have to be part of stopping this. And to get from people's well-meaning sentiments to a movement that is actually, look, things only change through struggle. Things only change through struggle and sacrifice. And this Rise Up October, it's a powerful effort. There's a powerful movement coming together. And this is a moment that we need to rise to. And I think it's eminently possible to shut down Rikers. I think it's eminently possible to stop this genocide. I think it's going to be work. I think it's going to be struggle. But there's a lot of people that if we could wake them up and we could move the moral compass on this, could be roused. And once people are roused, you can change a lot of things.
All right. On that note, we're going to wrap it up. Sansara Taylor, writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. Thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm so glad to be with you. Okay. Thank you, Michael.
And see you on Saturday. Okay. All right.
I hope so.
All right. Sisters and brothers, you've just been listening to a talk I had with Sansara Taylor just a couple days ago about the action to shut down Rikers Island.
We're also going to hear from Leah Nesto, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, right after the action on Friday the 23rd.
Leah Nesto, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing very good, as you can hear. Listen, you were out at Rikers Island this morning. What actually happened?
I'm still out at Rikers Island. I'm still
okay.
Out here.
What actually is happening?
Okay, so there was an action out here today to shut Rikers down, shut Rikers Island down as part of Rise Up October. There was a large demonstration right at the entrance to Rikers Island, about 125 people, and about 19 people put their bodies on the line and did a nonviolent civil disobedience and were arrested. And I just want to say, you know, people were really motivated to get the word out about the kind of torture that is going on in Rikers. I mean, Sansara Taylor, she talked about how our bodies, our lives are not more important than those inside. And that if we turn our backs on them, we you know, forfeit our own humanity. And Carl Dix, you know, kicked it off. He talked about how 85% of those in Rikers are just awaiting trial because they can't pay bail. This is like a debtor's prison. And a statement was read from Cecily McMillan, who did time in Rikers from being arrested at an Occupy demonstration, where she talked about how every day people die in Rikers. People get raped. People get tortured. Families call in to find out about their loved ones, and they're just told they're no longer here. And then later they find out they were cremated and just buried. You know, people carry huge signs with the faces of people who have been beaten, some of them killed by the police. But out of the 20 of them, 11 of them were people who had died in Rikers. There were families there who came whose loved ones had been killed by the police, and they stepped up and talked about, you know, how they had come out to stand against the kind of torture that's going on in Rikers. And when people got arrested, people started chanting, "We are Kylie Browder." He was the 16-year-old ended up in Rikers after he was accused of stealing a backpack. After 3 years of beatings, terror, abuse, and solitary confinement, and lack of mental health services, Mr. Brower was released due to lack of evidence. And then in June of 2015, after struggling with issues of mental health, he was found hanging inside of his home. And people, you know, were chanting, "I am Kylie Brower." And when people were arrested, they were chanting this. There were many other stories that people brought out about people who had been basically beaten, tortured, and killed inside Rikers. That we can no longer stand by and just let this go on. This is what motivated people to, like, come out today and for some people to take the step of putting their bodies on the line.
How many people were arrested today?
I think, I believe the count was about 19. I'm not completely sure.
And what's going on there now? You said you're still out at Rikers?
Well, I'm not right at the gate, yeah, but we're just getting ready to leave.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to emphasize that, you know, that many of the stories, like, you know, there was another story of, you know, Bradley Ballard, a 39-year-old man who suffered from schizophrenia. He spent 7 days in solitary confinement. This is how they deal with mental health. He was denied food, water, medication for his diabetes, and he was found naked, covered in feces, with his genitals swollen and badly infected, and he died in a hospital hours later. This is the kind of thing that's happening in Rikers. This is what motivated people to come out today and say, we have to shut down this torture chamber. These are the kind of stories that people stepped up to and testified about why they came today and why they were determined to shut this place down.
All right, Lee, we're going to have to wrap that up with that. But thank you very much for giving us a very gripping and very mind just, oh, God, it just makes you full of rage. So thank you very much, Lee.
Okay. All right.
Take care.
That was Lee Onesto reporting from the scene of the Shut Down Rikers protest on Friday, October 23rd. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll hear an interview I did during the march on Saturday, October 24th, with director, actor, and writer Quentin Tarantino. Since the march on October 24th, Quentin Tarantino has been publicly attacked by the head of the New York Police Union for calling out the cops as murderers. So we should all pay attention to this situation for sure. And we'll also hear from some of the family members who spoke about the impact of the genocidal murders of black and brown people and why they have to stop.
Quentin Tarantino, you came out on Thursday, uh-huh. and it was very moving. I mean, I was there just listening to those stories. And then you come out today, and you're pretty, you know, it's pretty important that you're out here, like your voice is out here. What made you feel compelled to be here?
Well, what made me feel compelled, basically, is I'm a person, I'm a human being, and I have a conscience. And I've been sitting here, and I've been watching for, you know, it's been going on for a long time, but for the last year and a half, it seems like you just see one black or brown man, a woman, killed, murdered by the police, unarmed. And I believe that there is I believe there's a problem in the police culture itself that is corrupt, and the culture needs to be changed. And the thing about it is, if I actually do feel that it is murder, and it's not extenuating circumstances, then I have an obligation to stand with the murdered against the murderers. And that's what I'm doing here.
Yeah. Now, do you ever, you know, a lot of people have made the reference to a genocide, a slow genocide, yes, mm-hmm. but a genocide that's in formation and actually taking place uh-huh. as we go along. What do you think of that?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, to me, the whole mass incarceration situation that's been going on for the last 20 years, I think 30, 40 years from now, people will call it Slavery Part 2. American Slavery Part 2. And this is all, and that is a byproduct, and both, and that issue and this issue are married to each other. They're linked in arms.
Absolutely.
And look, my job isn't to be the most eloquent person speaking on this subject that there is. There's a whole lot more people here more eloquent than me, but I can put my body here.
Right, and also it does make a difference if your voice is heard.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, because look, there's people in society who have disproportionate influence mm-hmm. based on the work that they do in a lot of times, mm-hmm. and in your case in particular.
Yeah.
So it makes it, and no matter what it is, it's actually important when someone like you comes out and stands up and says, look, I see what's going on. I can't sit there and pretend I don't.
That's the thing. I mean, one of the things about the movement that actually just means so much is there's, you know, they have a powerful slogan. Which side are you on? You know, if you're not on our side, you're on their side. There is no straddling the fence. There's no silent majority. There is none of that. You have to take a stand. If you believe it's murder, then you gotta call it murder. And you gotta call the murderers murderers.
Absolutely. Just one more and we'll be through. Two more. One is the Niemöller quotes have been coming up in my mind a lot in mm-hmm. relation to this. You know, first they came for these people and I didn't say anything and it goes down the line.
Then there's
the second one that he talked about that a lot of people don't talk about, which is, what, and it speaks to this last point you made. What if, when he got out of the concentration camp, he said, I have to think, what if we had stood up? What if we had spoken out? What if we had done something?
Yeah, yeah.
Think of how many lives might not have been taken.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it's just like, it's funny. A lot of people here involved in this movement, some of them are very different minds about what should be done. And some of them are for all out revolution. I like the idea of that, but I actually think I don't think that's the only answer. I actually do think that massive resistance, which is what this is, can stop this, can put a pause in it, can put a second thought in it with these cops. And I do believe that there is a corrupt culture inside of the police force that needs to be straightened out. They are just too authoritative. Nobody should be stopped and actually have no rights during that encounter until later. That's just untenable.
Yes, exactly. What would you say to people who hear your voice now? What would you say to them about what they need to be doing?
Well, if you don't believe the way we believe, sorry, honey, if you don't believe the way we believe, well, then you don't, and then that's where you stand. But if you believe where we're coming from, and you believe that it is murder, and you believe people are being killed, then you have to say something. You have to join. You have to stand up. You have to join with us. And there's a lot of different ways you can do that, but you need to.
Now,
because that's the only way it's going to stop.
Right. That was, I was just going to ask you, how actually do you see it being made to stop?
I actually do think that if this happens enough, and it actually becomes, you know, like a 60s movement thing in a real way, which actually would be very interesting, because the civil rights movement was led by young people in the 60s. This is being led by moms. This is being led by fathers. This is being led by family members, and young people are catching up. And that's a really terrific thing. And so I think that it literally can be a situation is if it comes out there, then we can change the police force. We can change the way the police academy teach people, how they teach the police. And we can get rid of some of these cops. You should have a higher calling to be a cop. You know, there's like a whole thing of, we expect our doctors to aspire to a higher calling, not just have a job. We expect the people who work, the paramedics and the ambulances, we expect them to aspire to a higher calling, not just have a job. All right, and we need to expect that from the police. They're not just having a job and things happen.
All right, Quentin Tarantino, thank you very much for talking with us today. All right, take care.
Next, I would like to introduce Miss Marion. She comes to us from Prince George County, Maryland. And she is here representing her son, Gary Hopkins Jr., who was killed by police. Please welcome Miss Marion to the stage.
Rise up! Rise up! What side are you on? What side are you on? What side are you on? Say his name, Gary Hopkins! Say his name, Gary Hopkins! I'm here today, and I want to thank everybody for being here. This is one beautiful sight, a beautiful sight. Gary would be so proud of America right now when he look across this audience and see all the folks that are here to say enough is enough, and what side are you on? Gary was 19 years old, murdered on November 27th, 1999 in Prince George's County, doing what he had the right to do. Just 16 days before my son was murdered, my husband, his father, died from bone cancer. Gary, who was a full-time college student working a part-time job, was invited to attend a dance by his supervisor, which was his right. Gary was at the dance when one of his friends got into an altercation with another party-goer. Gary, being the one who was always a mentor to his peer group, actually broke up the fight, got everybody into their vehicles. They were trying to exit when a police officer blocked them from exiting, gets out of his patrol car, gun drawn, comes up to the car where Gary was sitting on the outside ledge, waving everyone on, pulled Gary by his collar. Gary stumbles forward to get his balance. Second officer, Officer Brian Catlett, calling him out, pulls him off of the car. He does the fatal shot. So we often talk about, folks, we need to indict these police officers. We need to rise up and make sure that there are convictions for the wrongful, unlawful murder of our loved ones. We can't just let this be where we are marching here today. We have to take action. When this is over, we need to take action. You need to be getting to your elected officials and say, we've had enough. We know what side we on. What side are you on? So we need to rise up, people, and let this stop. My son was unarmed. There was no drugs. There was no alcohol. They indicted the police officer. They indicted him, but there was no conviction. 99.9% of the time, these officers will take a judge bench trial because they're all in it together. They're all in it together. We need to hold all of them accountable, not just the police officers. Anybody involved in the process need to be held accountable. And we as the people, if we stand up, if we rise up, we can make this happen. Thank you.
Up next is Latoya Howe. She's the mother of Justice Howe. He was murdered April 4, 2015 by police in Zion, Illinois. She's a leader in the movement to stop police terror. Y'all give her a round of applause.
Thank y'all for being here. If you don't know the story of my son Justice Howe was murdered by Zion, Illinois police. Running in fear for his life, they shot my son twice in the back. Not once, but twice to make sure he was dead. Cuffed him, then pretended to perform CPR on him. First of all, that's not right. They're trying to tell us that we're not humans, that we don't have human rights, that we're not supposed to fight or flight. That's wrong. And if y'all don't hear me, something is wrong with you. If the nation doesn't hear us, something is wrong with this nation. And this system needs to take their feet off of our necks, because we will be heard, and we will be heard here today. It's a lot of family members out here. We got Tony Robinson's family. We got Daniel Colorado's family. We got Brandon Jones. We got Craig Baker's staff. We have a lot of families that's out here. And let me tell y'all, all the stories in the same. No indictments. There will be, all of us will have time to speak at the end of the march. They trying to roll us along, because if y'all look to the left and look to the right, look in front and look behind you, we got the police trying to get us out the way. They want to sweep us under the rug. So let's make noise in the building. No justice! No peace!
Those were the voices from October 24th, the National March to Stop Police Terror. That brings us to the end of yet another edition of the Michael Slate Show. And I want to thank all of the people who helped make this show possible today and over the last 2 weeks. I want to thank all the folks at WBAI, my engineer, Reggie Johnson, Bertold Reimers, the general manager of BAI, and Jeannie Hopper, the program director. I also want to thank all the people in LA who helped make these last 2 weeks happen. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, Nia, who works so damn hard on my website, themichaelslateshow.com, and Jennifer Kaiser, who works on our social media and ideas section of the show. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, please do at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with Sound the Alarm from the Thievery Corporation, because that's just what we need to be doing. Talk to you again next week.